Coming today on Breaking Free, a modern divorce podcast.
I completely understand where a significant other has to put a boundary in place for their own health to realize that I can no longer be in this relationship because of the effect that it's having on me. And we see that all the time as well. So addiction is nasty, and mental health issues are corrosive to relationships and to families. And quite often a spouse leaving is in the best interest of the family and that person's health.
Welcome to Breaking Free, a modern divorce podcast with Rebecca Zung and Susan Guthrie.
This is the place to hear other people's stories, to learn from the top experts in every related field, to also have some fun, laugh, and hang with two divorce attorney girlfriends who are also top family law litigators.
Breaking Free Mediation is proud to be the very first family law mediation centers in the country to offer a mindfulness track. Breaking Free Mediation, helping you resolve family law matters peacefully. Learn more at www.breakingfreemediation.com.
Also, make sure to download your free calming meditation from renowned meditation and energy expert Scott Picard at www.breakingfreefromdivorce.com/free meditation.
And now we invite you to listen to today's show.
It's going to inspire you to transform and break free. Welcome to today's podcast. This is part two of a two-part episode, Loving an Addict or Alcoholic, How to Help Them and Yourself, with president and founder of Veritas Solutions, Stephen Wolt.
You know, I'm thinking about something that you said in what you were saying earlier, Stephen, because many of our listeners are at that point, and Rebecca and I have seen this over and over again, where they are the spouse who has an addicted spouse, and they have begged that spouse to get help for years. They have threatened to leave. They have, you know, over and over looked to try and get their spouse to get some help with that, and it hasn't been successful. So they eventually end up in our office saying, I can't do this anymore. And you mentioned earlier something that I do think is a common myth, that you can't force someone into rehab. But you said the top three ways people get into rehab were court-ordered, family and friends, and I'm afraid I can't remember the third one.
Yeah. Employer.
Yeah. Employer, right. So they're all compelled. So what can you talk a little bit about how you get someone to get help?
This is not to diminish how excruciatingly painful and difficult this process can be. I could tell in my own journey, my family had to intervene on a number of occasions where they came together, had a sense of unity, and really were adamant and demanded that I go away and get help. So that was a perfect example. I would have never on my own accord been able to kind of get to a place where I volunteered and said, okay, guys, I'll see you in 30 days. So there was an example. I've also had situations in my life where my business partners mandated that I go and said, Steve, you're a very valuable asset to this company. And but at the end of the day, you put this company at risk based on your addictions, and we can't have it. And it's okay that you're dealing with these issues. It's not okay that you're not getting help for them. And so once again, there was that kind of leverage that was used successfully for me to kind of get out there and get the help that I need. And I think that levered the sad reality to all of this is there are many, many failures. So I might be sitting here as a success. I might sit in rooms throughout the week where there are incredible success stories of people that are dealing with addictions, who have overcome their addictions, whose kids and wives or husbands are back in their lives and they're living wonderful lives. But the reality is that's the minority. So there's always hope out there, and we go to any length to try to help people kind of start their journey and process. But I completely understand where a significant other has to put a boundary in place for their own health to realize that I can no longer be in this relationship because the effect it's having on me. And we see that all the time as well. So addiction is nasty, and mental health issues are corrosive to relationships and to families. And quite often a spouse leaving is in the best interest of the family and that person's health. So I understand that as well. There's only so much someone can take for their own sanity and health, and they need to move on.
So I, just going back to the person's in a relationship, and I mean normally like a romantic relationship, but it could be another type of relationship where they're being affected directly by this person who is an addict. I've heard you say, you know, that there's a lot of shame around it and things like that. So I would assume that one of the don'ts is, you know, don't try to shame them further. Would that be fair to say?
Yes. And I think there's so much shame and stigma around addiction that makes it really difficult to talk about, whether it's in a corporate setting, whether it's in a family setting. And I have just found in my own journey that safety is critical in me opening up and being comfortable to talk about what's really going on. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, 12-step rooms work so well. There's a common bond, there's empathy, and there's safety where someone feels comfortable to open up and share about these things. So, you know, even with a loved one, to be able to kind of get to a place where you're engaging in a dialogue around these issues. And I think that's critically important in fostering a healthy conversation around these issues.
But what if the person just says, I don't have a problem, you're the one with the problem, or I drink because of you, because you're so awful? You know, I've heard people in relationships like that. What do they do then?
Well, you have Rebecca's telephone number on speed dial. I don't know what you do then, right? So it's awful, and that happens more often than not. So that's why you talk about the three A's about the deadly sins in a relationship. There's a perfect example of a corrosive effect that has on a relationship. So, you know, there are lots of resources out there that people can tap into, you know, whether it's therapists that have experience in dealing with these issues. There are therapists out there that are have the ability to work with the spouses of a partner that might be struggling with addiction. So there's a real professional community around that will provide resources and expertise on how best to move forward in this relationship. So A, you don't have to do this alone. There are 12-step programs out there, or with Al-Anon and codependency, that could be helpful as well to get support, get information and guidance from other people that have gone down a similar journey. So I guess what, as complex as this can be and as confusing as this can be, I guess the message is you don't have to do this alone. Right, there is a lot of resources out there that people can turn to for guidance and support to how to deal with these issues.
You know, you mentioned codependency, and that's such a complicated part of a family story when there's an addiction or mental health aspect for one of the parties. Can you explain just a little bit around codependency so that our listeners understand, the ones who have, you know, don't have a good grasp of that concept?
You know, it's interesting because, as I understand codependency, it's really from my own journey with addiction, it is the people around me have gotten sick as a result of my addictions, whether it was my mom, my siblings, girlfriends, where their own survival is contingent upon my survival. And there's really a progressive nature to that as well. But you know, codependency, as I understand it, is really getting one's self-identity and self-worth from how someone else is doing. And you know, I could just tell in my own journey, the profound effect that my addiction had on loved ones. When I look back, and as much as I'm excited about the ability to help people or to help companies with these issues, there's still tremendous pain around how my behaviors affected those that were close to me.
I know I mentioned, because you were at one point, we had all gone out to dinner, a group of us, and you had said you were going back east to spend time with your parents or whatever. And I said, oh, what a good son. And you said, oh, no, this is penance. And that was funny. Especially, I grew up Catholic, too. Yeah. So that word has, you know, how many Hail Marys and Our Fathers can you say?
Yeah, my mom has rosary beads just for me.
Oh, I'm sure she's praying to Saint Monica, because, you know, she turned around Saint Augustine. For those Catholics out there, they know what I'm talking about.
Of course.
So I wanted to go back to your discussion around the intervention and the leverage conversation, because, you know, at the time that your family had it, what I would call an intervention, I don't know if that's what you would call it, but, you know, where you said they gathered you all together and basically said, go get help. What leverage does a family really have over someone who is kind of independent? I mean, you were an adult at that point. You said you were making a lot of money. So tell us about what that leverage looks like.
So I think, you know, in working with a lot of men who are in early recovery, early recovery can look really ugly, and where people are asked to leave the house, not allowed to see their children, a lot of restrictions around those areas. So, you know, from that perspective, I think that those types of leverages can be useful in getting someone to start the process of getting help, whether they want to or not. You know, for me, you know, my relationship with my brothers and my mom in particular were really close. And I think deep down, I was so desperate for help and so scared that I knew this was what needed to be done. But the thought of alienating them or not having them part of my life and losing that was just too painful.
So the leverage is the relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, even though, you know, you can, so your family, all these interventions are all the court ordered, the family intervention that you were talking about, those are all things, those don't just come out of the blue. Bad things have usually happened that have brought the families to that point. I mean, that's where Rebecca and I have often come in. You know, we come in after someone's had a DUI and a spouse says, you know, I need court orders that they can't, you know, they can only have supervised visitation. Or so those restrictions that you're talking about, I know can be effective. But I heard one addict say to me one time in a case that I was involved in, though, was that all the restrictions that kept getting heaped on. We kept having to go back to court, and more, you know, access to the children was taken away, access to the home was taken away, that it increased that person's level of shame to the point where they drank to escape. And so it became an even more counterproductive downward spiral.
A vicious cycle.
It was very much a vicious cycle. And that person ended up, and I think this is a norm, that person ended up going to rehab several times, something like 8 times before sobriety was something that they could maintain. Is that something that you have found to be a truth, that you know, this continuum of downward spiral is not effectively stopped usually with one round of treatment?
Well, it wasn't for me, that's for damn sure. And I'm always a little envious when someone walks in for the first time and never picked up a drink or drug ever again. That certainly wasn't my journey. And you know, I've had to fail over and over and over again until I didn't. And the one thing I look back, and where my family had such an incredible message to me of not giving up. And you know, my family and friends were just so supportive in not allowing me to kind of give up on this journey and believing in me. I know that doesn't exist a lot of times in the family dynamic. But I was very fortunate to have incredible people around me that loved me until I could love myself.
We're going to take a quick break right now to tell you about our newest sponsor, the co-parenting app Fair. If that sounds familiar, we interviewed Michael Daniels, the creator of Fair, on episode 123, The Insider Secret to Seamless Co-Parenting. And Rebecca and I are very strong supporters of Fair because we think it supplies you with the best tools to improve communication with your co-parent. They have a time-sharing calendar, documentable text messaging, and an expense tracker to keep track of those shared expenses.
There's a GPS check-in that's court verifiable, a monthly parenting report to download with all your details, private journal to take notes, a file vault to keep your records, photos, and documents, and it's all downloadable in a convenient time and date stamp PDF when you need documentation for legal matters, and there's even a Spanish version as well. Fair allows you to experience co-parenting a totally new way. Simply, inexpensively, transparently, and fairly. Lose the he said, she said, and be the best parent you can be. Be fair. Subscribe at BeFair, BeFayr.com, and then download FAYR from the App Store or Google Play. Just go to fair.com for more details.
Coming up, more from Rebecca and Susan on Part 2 of Loving an Addict or an Alcoholic, How to Help Them and Help Yourself, with expert Stephen Wold.
I think we treat addiction in this country like you've been in a car accident and not like you have diabetes.
Take a listen to our archive, where you can hear Rebecca and Susan discuss more topics on divorce in depth, including Eat, Pray, Slay, how Ariel Laurie used wellness and transcendental meditation to power through addiction and create the life of her dreams.
You know, if you look at your life right now, people would think, oh, she lives this fairy tale life. You know, she's married to this television producer. She's got this beautiful, you're beautiful. You've got this amazing blog. You've got this cookbook, this whole thing. But your life was not always this amazing. I mean, you've had real struggles, and you know what it's like to have difficult times.
And now we return to today's show.
What's interesting, you know, I think you'd mentioned that when people come to you in your offices, that there's an event. And I always wondered, as divorce lawyers, you know, how much compassion do you guys have when someone comes into your office and their husband's a drug addict or an alcoholic or dealing with a sex addiction, as lawyers, do you use that as leverage to negotiate a better divorce offering? I always wondered how much compassion from the legal community there is when someone comes into your office and a spouse is struggling.
I would have to say it depends on the lawyer, obviously. Mm-hmm. There are lawyers out there that'll use anything, that'll use anything. To try to gain some leverage. As far as I'm concerned, it really only matters when there are children involved and the children may say, where safety in their care may be a concern. That does happen. And a lot of times people don't like that, but it does happen where you have to bring it out and make a big deal about it, because if they're driving with the children in the car when they're under the influence, or they're passed out and the children are walking around the house by themselves and they're not old enough to care for themselves, it's a problem.
Yeah, I've had all those situations. I've had moms show up to pick up the kids from school drunk. Mm-hmm. So it's not something. I've had my share of alcoholics and addicts in my life. I have compassion for that circumstance in life, and I know how difficult it is. But when you have people who are impacted, especially children, as lawyers, we have tools and we have to wield them to a certain degree for the benefit and protection of the innocents in the group. And also our client. If our client is the spouse who does not have addiction issues, they in many cases need some protections as well. But that's not to say that you can't build into the agreement or the court orders a continuum of loosening of restrictions if a person is able to get treatment, if they're able to get mental health assistance, if they're able to get themselves back on their feet. And that goes to maybe that leverage, you want to see your children. We have a pathway to that right here. But you have to do your part. I've always thought that with addiction, there's no blame in being an addict. As you said, it's a disease. But once you know you have it, the court system, at least, I have always found or felt, somewhat will hold it against you if you don't seek assistance. So once it's clear you have an addiction issue, then it becomes incumbent upon you, at least from a court's eyes in most of the cases I've dealt with, to do something about it.
Yeah, and I've seen people actually willingly agree to go to a neutral testing center to be regularly tested for drug or alcohol in their system so that they continue to see their children. And, where we've built into the parenting plan that if they have a positive test, well, then this whole section of the parenting plan is going to kick in. But if as long as they don't, then they have regular time sharing just like anybody else would, So it's not so much trying to shame the other person as it is to try to be pragmatic in building a parenting plan that's going to, make sure the children are safe. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the nexus between mental health and addiction, because a lot of times there are underlying issues. I know Elizabeth Vargas has talked a lot about, she was the CBS evening news anchor who talked a lot about her struggle with alcoholism, and she actually started drinking because of anxiety issues. And it actually helped her be less anxious. And then the way she describes it, it actually changed her brain makeup so that she became physiologically dependent upon alcohol. But I want you to talk a little bit about that, because I think when you do go to rehab and you do start to try to get help, now you have to deal with all of that.
Yeah, now you have to deal with kind of the reason why you're drinking. And I just know for me, you take away the drug, you take away the alcohol, or you take away pornography, I'm left with with me, with nowhere to turn to numb those feelings. So even in my own journey, I've had to get a lot of help one-on-one with therapists. I've taken antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications for years to deal with a lot of these issues. So I've had to attack this from a variety of different areas to give me the help that I need. And it's so interesting because, you know, a lot of times there's even stigma around taking an antidepressant, right? It's just, you know, it's incredible. I mean, we listen to commercials about erectile dysfunction all day long, and someone's going to be embarrassed about saying I take an antidepressant, you know, and I'm not, right? Because it's just the reality of it. And, you know, it's taken a long time for me to feel really comfortable talking about these issues, but I just think about how much shame there is over this.
Well, you know, they say you're only as sick as your secrets, right?
Sure.
You had a quote, and I want you to say it, but it's about how people are treating addiction. You said they're treating it like something, and they should be treating it.
I think we treat addiction in this country like you've been in a car accident and not like you have diabetes.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my own journey, and I base a lot of that based on my own journey. You know, the idea that I could go away to a treatment program for a few weeks and literally just detox, but have all of these other issues going on that it's just not possible to address successfully over that period of time. And then to re-enter my work, to re-enter the home and the stresses and pressures around that and produce meaningful results is really hard. Whereas if we were to look at this as a long-term project, where that we're going to manage these conditions and get care over an extended period of time. I've always believed that it's not the intensity of care that's really received, but the duration of care that someone receives that produces more meaningful results. So, you know, for me, you know, these are issues that I've had to work over time, years, to kind of address these issues. But, you know, making progress, but these things that have plagued me my entire life, are not going to disappear over a short period of time.
Yeah, I think it stuck with me what you said earlier about if we think we can take someone out of their environment for a 30-day treatment program and then plop them right back in there with all the same triggers and all the same issues and expect that, you know, their addiction, their mental health issues, everything will have cleared up in 30 days or 90 days even. It's a little facile based upon reality. So that continuum of care, you know, I've had clients go into treatment from, you know, a detox for a week and then a 90-day inpatient program and then a 6-month outpatient program. And then, you know, so it's really a matter of changing the underlying, you know, mental health issues, perhaps treating those, getting the antidepressant, getting the anti-anxiety or those issues dealt with, and then dealing with filling the void of what the addiction was filling, and then creating a new life around it, you know, when you get back into your real world. So it's a pretty complicated process.
And I know in addition to that as well, for me was I had to create a community. I had to have a tribe. You know, for me, these addictions, and, you know, it's so interesting. I heard someone say in a YouTube or a podcast or TEDx that the opposite of addiction is not recovery. The opposite of addiction is connection.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think about, for me, just how important it is for me to have a community, for survival, I believe that we heal in community, and you can, that community can be a bunch of different places, right? It could be Alcoholics Anonymous, it could be another 12-step meeting, it could be a group you're affiliated with, your church or whatever that might be. But it was so important to find a safe place where I could connect with other people that have a similar type of experience. And I just think that for me, what my community does for me is allow me to, almost like a chemistry lab, allows me to practice developing authentic, intimate relationships with others, which is something I've struggled with my entire life. I think that's one of the common themes that you'll see for people that struggle with mental health and addiction issues is really the inability to perform true connections with other human beings. And connection is where joy in life happens. So if you have an inability to connect with others, really tough to experience much joy in life. You kind of understand why you drink or do drugs or act out in other ways, because just the pain of that isolation is brutal. So I think it's also critically important to find a tribe, find a community that you can start building meaningful connections with that will be with you on this journey.
That is so, so powerful. I absolutely love that, and it's so true. We really only have about 2 minutes here, so I really want to make sure you get a chance to tell our listeners about your event that you have coming up.
Sure. So on September 17th, we are hosting an event talking about the mental health crisis in corporate America. It's a series of events. This one in particular is going to be talking about executives. You know, executives and their mental health are critically important to any organization. And so whether it is executive burnout, anxiety or depression, addiction issues, substance abuse issues, so important for people to learn about solutions and resources that companies can be bringing into their organizations to help these employees. Really designed, the event is designed for senior HR executives, CFOs, chief wellness officers, corporate board members to get some really great information on solutions. We have a great group of panelists speaking on topics from different industries. So if anybody's out there and listening and this appeals to them, please join us.
How can they get more information about that event and about you, Stephen?
They can go to our website, which is veritussolutions.com. That's veritussolutions.com. And you'll learn a little bit about Veritas and myself and how to go about contacting us.
Thank you so much. This is so powerful, and I know it's going to help so many people.
Great.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you for joining us today on Breaking Free, a Modern Divorce podcast. I'm Rebecca Zung.
And I'm Susan Guthrie. Breaking Free Mediation is proud to be the very first family law mediation centers in the country to offer a mindfulness track. Breaking Free Mediation, helping you resolve your family law matter peacefully. Learn more at www.breakingfreemediation.com.
Also, make sure to download your free calming meditation from renowned meditation and energy expert, Scott Picard, at www.breakingfreefromdivorce.com/free-meditation.
Check back next Monday for our next edition of our powerful, inspirational, and educational podcast. And if you enjoyed today's podcast, please remember to give us a 5-star rating and let us know what you liked in a review on iTunes.
And remember, you're just one step away from your new life.